welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And I'm hoping that people are feeling the urgency and acknowledging the need for the power of prayer. With that, because I don't want to go through all the obligatories, I'd like to kind of close out on the Constitution. Not that every part of it isn't important, but there's a lot of other content that I've never covered before that we need to cover by the end of the year. And so diving through the amendments and understanding the Bill of Rights, I think is probably the most important part. And that is because the 14th Amendment applies these protections against the states. So in other words, the states can't be creating laws that violate these privileges and immunities. And so as we kind of finished covering the Bill of Rights, we've got Tammy with us. I mean, we covered the assembly and the petition, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so just as a summation, there are very significant things in the first Bill of Rights that was ratified. We already covered the first two amendments. And so now we've covered technically the first of the first three amendments that were submitted as the Bill of Rights. The next amendment, or the fourth amendment, which everybody calls the Second Amendment, is regarding the right to bear arms, or actually more important, the protection of the people to enforce or execute the Constitution. So when we covered, because most people, they don't read the entire Constitution, they just read the amendments. So when you just read this, and go ahead and just read this amendment, and then we'll kind of place context of the Constitution. Go ahead.
Number four?
Yeah, the fourth article or the Second Amendment, correct.
Oh, okay. Well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Okay, so does it say that the right to bear arms shall not be infringed only, or is there something that really lays the groundwork here of why the right to bear arms shall not be infringed? When we look at
the security of a free state.
Well, so the necessity of the militia for a free state. And so when we look at the militia in this Constitution is responsible for executing the laws of the Union. So the only way a free state can be maintained is that we execute the laws of the Union. In other words, we actually support and defend this Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. And therefore, we are to ensure that the laws are being abided by, the rule of law is maintained, that any insurrection be suppressed. So when we saw what was happening in the streets, the Constitution was being violated during 2020 when Kentucky, or I should say, what was it, Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm forgetting, starts with an L, Louisville in Kentucky. And we saw in Milwaukee, we saw in Minnesota, Seattle, all around the nation, we saw a bunch of mayhem by an insurrection where the people were not going to abide by the law. They destroyed property, and they basically invoked fear. That action right there is absolutely not permissible in this nation based on the Constitution. We're supposed to be a civil society. The fact that our courts and the fact that the progressives have changed the narrative that, oh, we have a right to protest, only allows, supports, and invokes anarchy, because that's what protests do. They're anarchical. It is, and I've said this before, anarchy is the tool of communism because what it does is it sets the stage for the state to lock down. And that's exactly what happened in January when the federal government locked themselves down and said, thou shalt not come to us. You cannot petition. You cannot assemble. They allowed the assembly. But when they tried to petition, even though it was the worst executed petition because they didn't even have a petitioner claim to. And when it went into the court and when it went into the public eye, nobody was speaking. What about our right to petition government against the redress of grievances? That is a right that they denied us by locking those doors.
Yeah.
So when we understand the Constitution, we actually have full control of the narrative. But when we don't understand it, they can pretend and they can make us believe that what they're doing is legitimate.
Right.
Okay. So understanding this whole concept of the Second Amendment isn't just about the right to defend your property. It is the right and the obligation, more importantly, the legal obligation we all have in supporting and defending that Constitution. I've said this, and I've said this, and I've said this. Every state in this union is required by the Constitution to have laws that will compel the people to take up arms to defend and support this Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. Unfortunately, there's more people that would rather tear, destroy, and abandon the Constitution today than are willing to take up arms and defend it. But the question is, where are the arms residing in America to where we can either stand and say, no, we're going to support and defend this Constitution and demand it? Because bottom line, when a person has to run out into the streets to attack, the person in the defensive position has the advantage. They've got the cover and so forth. So as our Constitution is being under attack, we actually have the advantage. So even if the odds are in their favor, we have the advantage. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I know that there's a lot of people that just say, why would it have to go this? And actually, we got to keep it from going to that. We have to actually help people understand that have been basically indoctrinated into these terrible antithetical principles and ideas, antithetical to what the Constitution means and what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to have civil dialogue. And our education system has basically created a bunch of Karens that people just have meltdown. They're not rational. They're not capable of actually having civil dialogue. This is why the Karens, and I apologize to anybody by the name of Karen, because you have been terribly labeled by this very bad paradigm. So I hope this kind of covers the importance and the significance of the Second Amendment. It is not just simply your right to defend yourself and your property. It is your responsibility to actually take an active role in basically enforcing the Constitution, in suppressing insurrections, and in repelling invasions. Active role, not just a passive role that you come on my property, I'm going to shoot you. No, we need to get out there and we need to basically start suppressing these insurrections. We need to actually repel these invasions and execute the law. So the next amendment, which is one that's kind of interesting, and it is one that doesn't really come up much, but go ahead.
No soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law.
So in other words, when government comes along and they need to set up a encampment or, you know, a operation center, nine times out of ten when they're doing this in search of, you know, a kidnapped girl, runaway kids, or some kids in trouble, I mean, nobody even bats an eye. And nine times out of ten, They aren't quartered in the house. They bring their own tents. They have the portability of setting up an encampment, right? And so the principle behind this was that government couldn't come along and basically occupy your property without basically this being prescribed by law. In other words, so...
Which they did during the Revolutionary War.
Well, yeah, they did, but let me do this. Does this say that it goes to the judges to basically determine whether they can do it or not?
No.
Does this say that if the executive, the governor, or the president thinks it's necessary that they can do this?
No.
What this says is that the power resides in what?
The legislature.
The legislature, our representatives. Is this a judiciary, executive, or Republican form of government when you look at this? And as a matter of fact, when you look at the Constitution, every time when it talks about prescribed by law or the regulations and so forth, it always points to Congress. It always points to the legislative body.
Yeah.
Because the legislature or our legislators are the sovereigns, collective. We all have our own representative in there, and they're to protect us.
Yeah.
By ensuring that they pass laws that are in pursuant to the Constitution. Because we know when all of a sudden somebody has, you know, accumulates the power, like Lincoln, they throw out the Constitution and they do what they think is necessary. So, anyway, okay, so the big thing here is that this cannot just be done. And nine times out of ten, when people say, well, the sheriff can do this, is the sheriff our legislator at the county level?
No.
No.
No, absolutely not.
Right. So that's the whole point. Then this goes into, and as a matter of fact, I'm highlighting this because this right here is, to me, something that really speaks more towards a Republican form of government and speaks opposite of what we would call a magistrate form of government, an executive form of government. Because nine times out of ten, the Congress, because like with the Whiskey Rebellion, Congress quickly just gave it to the president, right? But the whole spirit behind this was to ensure that the legislatures would always be in control to protect us. So
where do they think that they get the power to write executive orders all the time?
So an executive order started with George Washington. And an executive order was how Washington was going to be, when he was given a law, we have to do this, then he would create an executive order of how his administration would actually, you know, the process or the way they were going to enforce that law.
Mm-hmm. So executive order was just an order to fulfill the law that was already written.
It's an administrative order that basically deals with the administration and the management of executing the law. Correct. Does the president have the ability when Congress basically says that, you know, we're going to put a tax on whiskey? And so that basically goes, you know, they pass this law and they put it out there. So the executive, the president, then has a responsibility of how we're going to, you know, execute this throughout the United States. His job is to faithfully execute the law. So he has to basically go and communicate to the marshals to work with the local law enforcement, the sheriffs or what have you. And ensure that, you know, everywhere where they're manufacturing whiskey, they report what they've made and what they've sold so that that can be taxed. What was sold was taxed. So that way, and that's what they actually did. The marshal went around and created a ledger, and they actually, so the marshal wasn't a gunslinger. He was more of an administrative pogue. And so, and if necessary, we all are to, you know, be able to, one, defend ourselves and enforce. So the Fourth Amendment, or the Sixth Article, is probably one of the most important, because this is the one that is being trampled almost in every direction today. So let's go ahead and read this one.
The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
Right. And so when we look at the FISA warrants, when they actually started signing those, they changed the tone of the Constitution, where all of a sudden this probable cause, you know, it basically, when you were labeled as a terrorist, then all of a sudden the signing of a warrant, the threshold was diminished completely, to where people were losing their rights because the label of a terrorist was attached, and they used FISA warrants to basically go or backdoor these rights that we have protected. Now, it's one thing if they amended the Constitution for that, because what would happen is the states would actually have to buy in. I mean, I'm okay if the states buy in and make a change to that, to say, you know, we consider this one thing, terrorism, to be, you know, an untenable problem, that we, you know, we need to be able to execute warrants in secrecy so that we can, you know, find the bad guys. But there has to be, and if we went down the path of creating an amendment for, you know, these warrants and being able to do searches and seizures with terrorists, there's no doubt in my mind the threshold of ensuring that good citizens' rights would still be maintained would be upheld even better than the way they concocted it. Does that make sense? Okay, because they just concocted it so that they had more latitude, which is why citizens have actually, you know, it's defied the spirit of this whole protection, the whole reason why they created this. So, more importantly, when it says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. So if you have information and a corporation, you know, because you've got software, because, you know, you're using a platform like Facebook, or because you've purchased things, and all of a sudden these corporations are outright providing the data and information to government to start connecting the dots. Does that mean that your rights are not being violated because corporations are doing it?
No, well, they're being violated.
Ah, so corporations are entities that are created by government. In other words, they're sanctioned by the government and regulated by government. So in other words, when we look at corporations, technically a corporation is, they call it a non-government organization, but I'm here to tell you it is governed. Everything that is created under the sanction of government means that they have, you know, the government has the ability to come in and say, give us this information. And therefore, there needs to be either a severance so that government cannot access any private data without basically issuing the warrant. And so I honestly believe that we need to actually bolster this one particular amendment to ensure that when a warrant is being pursued, that the person the warrant is being pursued for is actually notified. Because bottom line, when they actually start using tech information, this is not, we're not talking about an active crime. We're talking about passive gathering of intelligence to determine and or to look at information. I just have a real problem. And I should say I have a real problem with government and corporations in cahoots, in spying on people. And as a matter of fact, I would much rather prefer that corporations cannot share any of that data without the person being notified first, because this is separate. We didn't create Amazon to be the cops to maintain, you know, peace and order, I should say, or the sheriffs to maintain peace and order within the streets of your city or town or your county. Amazon has no role or responsibility. They are a commercial enterprise. And the fact that they can share and have been sharing everything you look at on Amazon and everything you buy with government. I mean, all of that data on a daily basis is just openly provided to the government. They're not the only ones doing this. Everybody's doing it now. In other words, there's these corporations, these large corporations have basically become agents. Right? I mean, if you understand a CI, a confidential informant, all of these corporations are confidential informants to the government. In other words, they're on the payroll.
Yeah.
So, folks, we got a real problem, because even though, and this goes to the whole concept of why the Bill of Rights was ludicrous, when you really thought about down the road how government can innovate and how technology can come along, and all of a sudden we realize that the whole spirit of this amendment needs to be basically tweaked to include these entities, because back in 1787, when the Constitution was being created, there wasn't this big national corporation. As a matter of fact, the government has no authority to even be engaged with corporations in the first place. And then secondly, they didn't have these big corporations. The biggest corporations were plantations. They were family businesses.
Right.
So, there were factories that started coming along, but again, the biggest corporations in America at that point in time were plantations. They were family businesses. So I honestly see that we really need to go down this path of tweaking some of these things, but I'm just letting you know, folks, that the whole spirit of the Fourth Amendment has literally been put to the side.
Mm-hmm.
So the Fifth Amendment, which is basically the, you know, some interesting things in here. So let's go ahead and dive into this, and we'll cover this in, you know, in segments. So go ahead.
Okay. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury.
Okay. So that means, go ahead.
Okay.
And finish reading that.
Okay, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb.
Okay, so that's a separate one. The semicolon kind of separates them. So the first one is that no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on an indictment, a presentation or indictment by a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service or in time of war or public danger. In other words, that would be under martial law. So a person in the militia could be held for an infamous crime without having to go through, you know, this indictment for a grand jury. But if we're not in a martial law, which we're not right now, folks, even though people tell you we are, we're not. And if you haven't read it, you need to read my article, Martial Law in the 21st Century, because we do not have the militia. Notice the tie here. In the land or naval forces or in the militia, which means the militia at the state level. When we talk about land forces in America, that is the militia federalized. To be clear, that is when the federal government calls for the militia and basically federalizes them and brings them forward. So what we're going to do is we'll obviously go into a break. And when we come back, we'll kind of close out on this first part and then we'll cover the double jeopardy clause which follows this. So we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so the protection of the individual is clear. If you're not in an area under martial law, and because we can't be anymore because we don't have the militia. Does that make sense?
Right.
So what happened with the Dick Act is the federal government basically pulled in the militia and says, we're going to maintain and keep this, and we're going to kind of let you do administration. And then they invoked the draft, and they directed direct administrative actions. Technically, they can't do that. To do that, they needed to have the Constitution amended to give the federal government the direct control. The other part of the militia was the deployment, or I should say, excuse me, the militia was to be configured throughout the state. In other words, every county was to have an apportionment for each of its requirements for enforcing the law, repelling invasions, and suppressing insurrections. So when the militia got sidelined by the Dick Act, counties didn't need them anymore. But they did, because are we not going to execute the laws of the Union? Are there not times where suppressions of insurrections need to be done?
Mm-hmm.
And so with the federal government basically just saying we need so many people out of the state, instead of the state needs to ensure that the militia is covering the entire state and every county to meet the needs of the state. See, going back to that Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia is, what, instrumental in the free state? Let me go back to it. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. So in other words, the state has to maintain its own militia. So when they talk about this in the Fifth Amendment, when they're actually talking about, you know, this right of, you know, a grand jury being protected, that, you know, they just can't trump up a charge. They have to present enough data to actually get the grand jury to indict you. Then you will be faced, you know, then you can they be arrested to face charges. That they don't do that anymore. They actually, most counties don't do this anymore. So when we look at, you know, what is this except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when actual service in time of war or public danger is being applied. Again, public danger means that the militia is being deployed by either the governor, and then the governor can declare martial law, or by the sheriff if, you know, there's all of a sudden something going on. The way this was defined in Virginia was the only places where martial law could be declared is when the militia was being deployed and precisely where they're deployed. So if they're being deployed in a corner of your county, then the rest of the county is not under martial law, just that corner.
Right.
Okay. Because the whole intent was still to maintain and protect the people and their rights, but more importantly, they wanted to make sure that those who were in service were being able to be held to, you know, make it easier to hold them to that standard. Because what was typical, and the reason they did this, was because they knew that once you give a person a gun and they say, now we're going to go do this, they go and exert zealous, you know, they get a little zealous with their guns and they start firing and shooting people and so forth. So the intent was to actually, you know, make sure we had the ability to quickly hold somebody and try them for, you know, war crimes or being able to exert too much power. Does that make sense?
Then it kept the militia in check as well.
Right. It wasn't about really just taking away the rights of the people. It was about being able to keep those who we trusted with the guns to actually go and execute the laws to ensure that they're not using excessive force. Which is why the martial law was invoked when and where the militia is deployed, not throughout the nation, not throughout the county or state, only where they're deployed. Okay, so the next one is, nor shall any person be subject, because you read this already, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy. That means they couldn't stand trial for the same crime twice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what that meant. So go ahead and read the next one. Mm-hmm. Nor shall any be compelled.
Okay, nor shall any. Okay, hold on. Nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be.
Okay, just stop there. Let's just stop right there. Do you know what that line means? I refuse to answer on the grounds I could incriminate myself.
Right.
That's the Fifth Amendment. That's when people plead the Fifth Amendment. I can't answer that because I could incriminate myself. In other words, we actually have the protection of not ever having to confess on the stand. When under oath and when they're actually asking you questions, you have the right to invoke the Fifth Amendment protection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in heaven, it's a little bit different. But here on earth, it is, you know, you cannot be compelled to incriminate yourself. Okay, right. Now the last part. Go ahead.
Nor shall private property...
Well, I started with nor be deprived.
Nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation.
Okay, so this is protecting your property from seizure. In other words, the first thing is due process. In other words, if you're going to stand a trial, or if you're going to actually, you know, be hanged, if you're going to be incarcerated, or you're going to be fined, there has to be due process. There has to be a trial. And we'll get into the Seventh Amendment because some of these other amendments actually support the trial part. But the part of nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. What does that mean, without just compensation?
I mean, I would imagine they would have to come up with an agreement that the private property owner agreed to for them to take it.
Okay. So if they're going to just take your property, is there a threshold for the dollar amount of what they can just take or fine you? Or do they have to provide just compensation, even if it's for a penny? So let me help you answer that, because we need to skip to the next amendment, or actually we need to skip an amendment to answer this. Go ahead and read the Seventh Amendment. Which is
you
the
want
ninth
me to skip
article.
To the seventh?
Yeah, we're going to skip.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no facts tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law.
Okay. So, if they're going to take something from you because they feel eminent domain, which would be a part of the common law of the state, saying we have this, you need to take this land, is there a dollar threshold? If it's only valued at $5, then what is just compensation? Whatever they determine. If it's five, if they say we determine this be $5, but if you determine it to be thousands of dollars, then what happens?
I don't know.
Just compensation must be determined by a trial by jury.
Okay.
In other words, they can't administratively take your property and say, we're going to give you this amount. If the value is over $20, The jury has to weigh in, a jury of your peers has to basically look at your property and look at your claims. Because there's certain things that may be a part of that. And as a matter of fact, see, when we talk about just compensation, the government is basically kicking me off my property. I have to move. Well, they're only going to give me the value for the property. What about the cost of my moving? What about the cost of me finding a new place? What about the cost of me finding a place that's equal in the same intrinsic values, such as my view? You know, I have this view. Now, if there's no place other than these more expensive places where I still have this view, because how important in your property is the value of a view?
Mm-hmm.
See, when we really start looking at how a person can actually start articulating what the value of that property really is, wow. And then at that point in time, just compensation isn't necessarily what the government is going to say it is. It must be determined because the Seventh Amendment holds it to $20. If it's over $20, then a trial by jury will actually determine. So going into a trial like this, it would be really behooved of the victim who's losing their property to be likable. I mean, if you've been a jerk in the town and everybody really just hates you because you've just been a pain in everybody's butt, then you're not probably going to get a favorable outcome. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this kind of like lends to karma. But the whole point is that when your property is being taken, and it's just like if your car, they don't have the ability to take your car. That's not eminent domain for public use. In other words, they're not taking that car to basically drive around town so that they can take everybody around town. They're taking that car to sell it so that they can make money. So this concept of private property seizure, because it was, used in the commission of a crime.
Mm.
Is that anywhere here where they can do that? No. And as a matter of fact, when we get down to the Eighth Amendment, we'll actually talk about that as well. So let's go back up. And so I think we kind of understood this whole concept of private property and how it actually, we can't think of a case today where any property would be valued if they took property from you. It'd have to be in excess of $20, and it would require a trial by jury.
Yeah.
Now, they have created administrative processes and rules to say, we're not going to give you that, but the Constitution guarantees it.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we're not abiding by common law. Well, if the state that actually declared common law to be the law of the state, and they're saying the courts now say, well, we're not abiding by that. We've created this civil law. Well, hold on here. Did the legislature state so? This needs to be included here. When we covered the ratification debates, you may remember me saying that the only way the state can actually move away from common law, which they declared as the law of the state, even though it wasn't in the Constitution, it was done after the fact. It was done after the state was formed. And so once the state was formed, they basically said, okay, we're going to impose or practice common law. And what that meant was that that became granted or in the basis of the state and its legal system, that common law would be its foundation. The only way they could change the foundation would be literally to going to the people to say, we want to go to civil law and we need to amend the Constitution so that the state legislature could try to actually propose an amendment to the Constitution. It must be done by the state legislature, not by the courts. And what has happened is the court system has basically said, well, we find this problematic because we, you know, all of these trials by jury, we don't have the same outcome. We need to have more victories and more outcomes in our favor so that we can control these things. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So
so what do we do about it? Because
so this is where we actually
your land and you disagree, then you go into court and then you've just entered their jurisdiction.
Well, that's correct. So this is why counties matter most, and this is why we have to actually start creating constitutions for the county. And we actually at that in the process of creating the constitution, we need to declare common law be maintained, that it was declared and be maintained as the foundation of law for this county. And that basically I would put it in the Constitution that the only way it can be changed is by an amendment to this Constitution. And then this is why in your amendment process, you want to make sure you have a supermajority that requires 3/4 of the people of this county to, you know, to pass that amendment. Not by a majority, a simple majority. You need to protect these very important laws to protect the rights of the people. Because when you actually make it a democracy, then tyrants will take advantage. Right. And that's what happens. So anyway, so it's going to take the effort of what we're talking about. We actually have to create these petitions. We actually have to create these petition management teams, these committees. The committees need to declare what constitution is the legitimate constitution, definitize the constitution. And in definitizing the constitution, they're in the process, they actually have to recognize that the state has declared, and there's no evidence at the state legislature within the constitution of the state that they've changed the foundation of the law. So if the courts have decided to not abide by that, and without even telling anybody, well, we decided to take, you know, this concept of civil law and use case law and precedents as the foundation of our law, then hold on here. That's not common law. And we have to get back to that. And so the only way to do that is by actually getting the people to actually take their government back and say, we need to put back into the processes and put back into our government these things that protect us from government. So, and you know, and people go, oh, well, this is going to be really hard. Actually, it's not. It's not really hard. Because I think once you start going through and once you start realizing, you know, who these people are, how hard was it in America? I mean, maybe the good people of America were really blessed by these good men. Or maybe because the people of America or the people of your county, because they're good, they're decent, good people, they're just uneducated. But as people start getting educated, there's this old adage, and I truly believe this, reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. And the problem is that middle part. But these committees and the process of the committees learning and understanding, once everybody gets equally informed in understanding what this really means, then all of a sudden they go, wow, I mean, that's important. I never knew that, but now that I understand it and I understand the context of this, that's important. We need to maintain that. We need to go back to that.
Yeah.
Okay. So as we look at the Sixth Amendment, go ahead and let's talk about this.
In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation.
Okay. So when criminal prosecutions are to be done, one, the person has a right to a speedy trial. In other words, if they just arrest you, because many times in the arrest of a person, they need to trump up their charges. They realize that they just don't have a good case. And the protection of a speedy trial means that if you don't have a case, then it's being thrown out. Now, the problem with that doesn't mean, you know, all that means is they just can't keep you incarcerated. They can't keep bail over you or anything else. If they can't come up with a good, you know, prosecution, then they have to let you go. But the reality is that as they, you know, go through the research, they can always come back and rearrest you. The problem might be that you flee the area, you're no longer in the state, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, one, this is just to protect you from heavy-handed prosecution and law enforcement, okay? And so let's go ahead and let's go into the next one.
To be confronted with the witnesses against him.
Okay, so to be confronted with the witness against him. In other words, you have the ability to cross-examine and to challenge the witnesses against you. This is a right. You actually have the ability to actually challenge, you know, the veracity of that witness. That's what ends up happening in court, right? So what happens if all of a sudden your accuser is a camera? Like a camera, you know, traffic camera?
Good question.
Ah. Well, you have a right to challenge that accuser. And so bottom line, that becomes a violation of the Constitution. In other words, you can't use technology to basically, you know, maintain the law. Even as nice as we think it might be, the right of the person. So in other words, we actually have to employ in law enforcement and or we actually have to have people, you know, becoming the witnesses to say, I saw you steal that. I saw you hit that car and go down that path and, you know, and run away or whatever. In other words, you actually have to have somebody put their arm to the square and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So help them God. I don't think cameras are going to take an oath to God.
So are you saying they can't use cameras against us?
Not in America. Not in America. Because how is your right to basically confront your accuser? If the accusation is just simple that we're going to invoke this, you know, camera, then what we have to do is we actually have to change the Sixth Amendment. Because the Sixth Amendment, even if a state says we're going to allow, you know, law enforcement and enforcement of law by camera, technically that would violate the Sixth Amendment because the people's right to be able to challenge their accuser is not going to be upheld. So we would need to amend the Sixth Amendment to actually take that out. Or to say, you know, if the accuser is technology, we're willing to submit to whatever the outcome of technology is or whatever, something like that. It needs to be amended because at this point, if your accuser is a camera, you have a right to challenge it. And in other words, all it can do is just take a picture of you in court. And is that actually answering? Can they actually answer? They can't. They're inanimate objects.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is where technology has been implemented, and the Constitution actually has these levels of protection where they can't use technology as weapons against us.
Well.
Okay. Okay. Now, they can if we amend the Constitution, but the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And there's just no, see, in some efforts, there has been efforts where you can actually speak to a technician of the camera company to say, yeah, you know, we did this coding, we've done the test, it's, you know, it's within the parameters of properly functioning and so forth. But it can't attest that that was you driving that
so
car.
When they give a person a speeding ticket via camera, that's not constitutional?
Yeah, so let's actually use facial recognition technology and DNA. This goes right down to the Fourth Amendment. Do you have a right to be secure in your persons, your property, and your effect? If that car is your property and you're driving down the road, do you have a right to be secure?
Yeah,
without
absolutely.
Without probable cause and a warrant. You see how this police state, this 2020 Big Brother police state, how the Constitution protects us from them being able to set this up. Only he knew where we would be in these days, and he gave us everything we need to protect ourselves. You know, I say, you know, long pauses on radio is bad, but, and I know that, you know, there's like this light is coming on and you're going, wow, I can start seeing things. So when we start coupling that technology protection of the Fourth Amendment and this right here, the protection of being able to face your accusers, mm-hmm. Well, how did you gain that technology? Well, the computer did it. Well, does that mean that you were actually monitoring me, that I wasn't secure in my persons?
Well,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So the only way that they can actually collect data on you and write you a ticket is if they have a warrant by a judge for probable cause that we believe this person is going to speed on this road.
Yeah.
Okay, so see, when we really, you know, I'm just here to tell you that as you look at the whole picture, the right to face your accuser is one thing, but these other things of collecting data and so forth, they're all on the table of how we basically look and go, they can't use technology the way they're doing. Big Brother violates the essence of the Constitution.
Yeah.
And we have to stop being complacent in allowing government to just say, go ahead and govern us. We need to take the system back and restore our self-governing system. Okay, so the last part, we're actually running into the end of the show. So unfortunately, we'll actually have to wrap up this last part of the Sixth Amendment. But it looks like, folks, we'll probably be able to get through maybe in the next two shows, possibly, get through the rest of the amendments. Maybe. I can't promise you anything. But I can say this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email.
Thank you.